A signal event in the life of any university is a change in its leadership, and Cornell University is no exception. On March 11th, 2011, Cornell University's Board of Trustees elected a new chairman. His name is Robert S. Harrison. He's a member of the class of 1976, and he is Chief Executive Officer of the Clinton Global Initiative. Mr. Harrison's 2.5-year term will begin in 2012, when he will succeed Peter C. Meinig, class of 1961. As chair since 2002, Mr. Meinig has gone through one of the toughest fiscal periods of any chair in the university's history. I'm Susan Kelly with the Cornell Chronicle, and here with me today to discuss the state of the university are Mr. Pete Meinig and Mr. Bob Harrison. Thanks so much for coming to join us today. Pete, you've chaired the board, as we said, since 2002, and that period has included the Great Recession and a slow economic recovery. How has the university changed since then, and how are we doing now?
Well, I think all of you would agree, there have been many changes here at Cornell. I think there is an increased focus on the financial issues around the university. We are blessed to have great leadership from David Skorton. And as a result, David, together with the board, has instituted a complete review of the finances of the university. We have implemented many cost-saving measures. We have more work to do. I think another change is the situation with respect to our faculty. Over the next 10 years, more than half, I think it's close to 60% of our faculty will be retiring. And this is both a challenge and an opportunity. We will be dealing with that issue. We are dealing with that issue now. With respect to students, I think our student population continues to improve. The quality of the students is certainly much better than it was when I was here many years ago. And and certainly over the last 10 years, we see that Cornell is more and more competitive as far as the capability of the students that are trying to come to the university.
Bob, you also helped lead the board for many years now. You've been a trustee since 2002, but this is not your first experience as a trustee. In fact, you served as a student trustee as an undergraduate. Did you ever imagine that one day you would again serve as trustee and be elected chair of the board?
Absolutely not on the chair of the board part. That is a complete surprise. But I actually had hoped after graduating, given what an extraordinary experience it was being a student trustee, that I might be able to be fortunate enough to serve on the board at some point. And as you said, that did happen in 2002. You know, when I think back to the period when I was on the board as a student, 1975 and 76, it really is a dramatically different experience today for a student trustee and the way the board perceives student trustees than the way it was then. Back then, I would say it was a much more partisan situation where students looked at themselves as representing the students as opposed to representing the interests of the university as a whole. And I think the board essentially tolerated student trustees back then, whereas under Pete's leadership, I think the board values the student input. We really do look forward to hearing from our student trustees as a very important constituency.
Pete and Bob, let's talk about some of the difficult questions that Cornell and virtually every other university is facing today. And let's start with faculty hiring. Pete, as you had mentioned earlier, Cornell's faculty is aging, and a significant portion of the faculty are expected to retire over the next 10 years.
Right.
Now, Cornell has established a $100 million faculty renewal fund, for hiring as many as 1,000 new faculty members over this period. But how do we anticipate that we will raise that money? And how will we vie for replacements when peer institutions are also facing the same situation?
Right. Well, obviously it's a challenge, but we have committed to spend over the next 5 years $100 million. That will be raised $50 million from reallocation of internal resources by the president and the provost. And $50 million will be raised through philanthropy. And, you know, Bob and I and our development team internal at the university and the trustees will be working very hard to do that. We have a number of trustees that are very focused on this initiative. David Kroll, for example, has made a major commitment to this effort. And this is a unique opportunity. All universities are under financial stress today, some more than others. And we are really fortunate that, we have made a commitment that we are going to be very aggressive in faculty hiring. So it's a unique opportunity. Many universities will not be able to do this. And this creates a good marketplace for us with the endeavor that we are undertaking. So I feel very good about where we are positioned and what we plan to do over the next 5 years.
This is totally strategic in terms of next decades of the university's future. I mean, what we do over the next 5 years in replacing what are probably 1,000 members of the faculty is really going to set the course of the university for decades. And my understanding is that the fundraising is actually going quite well. I think of the $50 million that Pete mentioned, I think we already have about $11 million of that in Cornell's coffers.
Great, good news. Another issue that the board has been very active with is financial aid. The board has been extremely generous in improving increases for financial aid. And most recently, last summer, the university announced that it will match need-based financial aid for admitted students who are also accepted to other Ivy League schools. And it announced it will strive to match the need-based financial aid from Duke University, MIT, and Stanford. But can Cornell continue to increase the amount of student aid that will be necessary to bring deserving students to Cornell? Is there a level at which financial aid will become unsustainable for the university?
Financial aid is part of the DNA of Cornell. I think a majority of the students do get some form of financial aid. And I can't imagine the board decreasing its commitment. It's a question of priorities and how you allocate or reallocate resources. And even in the depths of the financial crisis 2 years ago, President Skorton was very interested in making a statement that we were not going to decrease, but in fact increase our commitment to financial aid. And given what's happened in the economy and given 9% unemployment, the families of many of our students are very seriously affected. So this isn't the time to reallocate downward.
Let me just add to that. I look at the university budget as being it's a balloon. And if you push in on one side, something goes out on the other side. So you have the major expenditures are salaries of our faculty and our staff, financial aid. The major inputs are tuition, support from the state, and philanthropy. And financial aid, the way you've asked the question, you can't keep ever increasing financial aid, but the policy at Cornell of need-blind admissions is something that is very important. It always has been important at Cornell, and in my view, it should always continue to be very important. So I think that Cornell will always look for ways to adjust its budget to increase its fundraising success such that we are always able to meet the needs of the most needy students that want to come to Cornell.
Another issue that the board has been very active with is the increase of underrepresented minority students. Financial aid affects them as well. We've made a number of initiatives that are hoping to increase the number of minority students here in the Ithaca campus and in New York City as well. The Dean of Students, Kent Hubble, has noted the need, though, to close an achievement gap and increase the number of underrepresented minority students who make the Dean's List and receive awards for academic achievement. And Cornell has announced a major initiative to seek these types of improvements. But is the university doing enough to ensure the success of these students?
Well, these initiatives, in many cases, go back to the 1960s, COSEP and some of the others that are the predecessors to the ones that we currently have. And I think what the university is doing by evaluating and reevaluating is exactly what needs to be done on a constant basis. And since I've been on the board this time around, David Harris, former Vice Provost David Harris, began the work, which Kent is now continuing. So I think it's really an ongoing effort that the university is very committed to do and must do.
Pete, any thoughts?
I'd just say, are we doing enough? The answer is no. You can never do enough. But I think there's certainly a focus from the board. There is a focus from the at the administration level also on the issue, and I think that focus is going to continue.
To continue talking about academics, a provocative new book is just out. It's called Academically Adrift: Limited Learning on College Campuses, and the book details research that finds that a large number of undergraduates are now failing in the basic skills of critical thinking, complex reasoning, and writing across the universities in America. In your view, are top schools like Cornell under a challenge from the nation's underperforming educational system, and also from many young students' lack of academic commitment?
My guess is that Cornell is less affected than many, many other universities, just given the fact that we've had 36,000 or more applications for 3,150 slots. So I think that we're seeing a population which is probably not exactly mirroring the one that book is referring to.
Pete, any?
Yeah, I agree with that? I agree with Bob from the viewpoint of Cornell, but I think universities, this is definitely a problem for higher education in general, and it really originates at the primary and secondary school level. The conversation going on in the country today about quality of teaching and measuring learning outcomes, I think is really fabulous. I mean, I'm involved with a group in Tulsa, which is trying to assist the secondary school system in implementing a system for measuring the progress that students make and using that as a way to attract and retain qualified teachers. And as we see, this is happening all around the country. And I think this is good. And it's going to help universities in general in the country.
Pete, given your extensive experience on the board, are there words of wisdom that you have or are anticipating giving to Bob as we make this transition over the next 6 months or so?
Yeah, I think what I would say to Bob is you're holding a jewel in your hands, and you know what. What the board needs to do under Bob's leadership is polish that jewel. You don't want to go and cut the jewel and change all the facets of that jewel. And so I think it's tweaking. I think it's the role of the board is one of advice and consent, choosing outstanding administrative leadership at the university, and then supporting that leadership. And Bob is fortunate in that He begins his term with a truly outstanding president that is a national leader in higher education and is a person that has the proper focus. So they will become a team, just as President Skorton and I think, have been a team. And I look forward to doing what former chairman should do in being available for advice when asked, and but being very much on the sidelines. But I look forward. I'll be very interested in what Bob and the board do, and I will be supportive in any way that I can.
In closing, Pete, what do you see as the university's greatest challenges from now to the sesquicentennial in 2015? What would you say are the greatest challenges and also the greatest opportunities?
Okay. Our challenges are in part financial, in part related to the human resources at the university. The financial challenge is in place because of, we definitely will expect reduced support from the state, and we have to deal with that in an appropriate way. We have to deal with the issue of faculty renewal, which we discussed earlier, and that's certainly a major challenge. I think we also have to look at the student experience here at Cornell. We've seen some of these issues come to the forefront over the last year or so. And these are issues, again, that I think are nationwide issues. And Cornell, because of our diversity, because of the makeup of our student body, I think has a unique opportunity to be a leader in finding and implementing the appropriate solutions to these challenges. I'm very optimistic about the future of Cornell and the future of higher education in general in the country.
Bob, how about you? How do you feel about the university and where it's going in the next 5 to 10 years? Challenges, opportunities?
Well, first and foremost is what Pete just mentioned on faculty renewal. I do think that's going to set the tone for decades to come, as we said earlier. Secondly, I think creating the caring community that we're trying to create and investing in mental and physical health of our student body and others as part of the Cornell community is critically important for some of the reasons that Pete just alluded to. And then finally, I would say that taking a hint from President Skorton and his desire to focus on public engagement in a global sense, in other words, making Cornell the land-grant university to the world, is something which is a challenge and a huge opportunity.
Pete, Bob, thanks so much for your insightful comments today. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Here's to you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.